I want to welcome you to the Older Adult Services of Professionals Affinity Group. And I want to introduce myself if I haven't met all of you. I'm Lisa Smith, the Chief Program Officer here at the network. And I am joined with our fearless chairs, Adam Halpern, who is at JFS in Seattle, and Christina Gelazzo, who is at JFCS, JCFS, JFCS, Gulf Coast. So one of you can take it from here, and then we'll introduce our guest speaker.
Okay. So we wanted to bring some meaningful topics of discussion for everybody. So Courtney has agreed to do a presentation on hoarding and home safety in the context of COVID-19. So Courtney Owen is from Jewish Family and Children's Services of Greater Philadelphia. She is a LCSW, and she's currently a Director of Individual and Family Services. So Courtney, Adam, if you want to say something else, otherwise we'll let Courtney go.
All right, hi everyone. I'm just gonna share my screen and start the PowerPoint. So I just, to let everybody know, I've been working with JFCS for 5 years, and I started at JFCS when they received a grant for the hoarding support program. And so we'll talk a little bit about how the inception came around. And this is just sort of the standard PowerPoint. I'm happy to share it with everybody after this. And also, I have some handouts that I can send out to everybody too that are sort of like a checklist of safety techniques that you have in the home and assessment tools that we use, which I can share later too. I can also, the PowerPoint doesn't so much talk about like updates to COVID because that's more recent, but I can definitely share with you some of the things that we've experienced and seen and how we have adjusted pertaining to COVID-19 and dealing with the hoarding program. So, the first thing is really to talk a little bit about what is hoarding disorder and why is it important that we talk about. So I'll just start here and say that hoarding disorder is an official diagnosis in the DSM as of 2013. It used to be categorized under OCD, but it is its own disorder. And the way that we define it is by sort of 5 specific categories, 3 that are really important to talk about. And to keep in mind that all 3 go together. So a lot of times we'll start talking about this and people will say, oh, that's me, or oh, that's so-and-so. Don't worry, it is a culmination of all 3. And also I think that it's really relatable, hoarding disorder, in the sense that we all have things. And I think one of the things that has made it really relatable is coronavirus. And we experienced this when the pandemic first happened and we were all sort of rushing to the store and collecting all the things that we could because we might not have them in the future. Or we might not be able to access things like toilet paper or disinfectant spray or hand sanitizer. And so if you reflect back on maybe some of those moments where you felt concerned about not being able to acquire something, that's definitely a relatable moment to those people who are struggling with hoarding disorder. So the first category is difficulty discarding. So this isn't somebody who just has a hard time throwing things away or holds on to sentimental items. This is somebody who really struggles with the idea of letting something go, that there is a significant attachment to those items. They feel like they'll lose the memory potentially attached to the item. They feel like it will contribute to like environmental impacts in a negative way related to discarding those items. They'll won't ever be able to acquire them again. What happens if somebody comes over and I need that item for something? Or food sometimes can be things that people hoard, especially if they've had a lack of food or grew up maybe in a household where they didn't have access to food all the time or things like that. So it's really the attachment to the item and the reason why they're not discarding them is really important here. And then also the accumulation of stuff that prevents the normal use of space. So there's kind of 2 things we're talking about here. One is acquiring items, and the idea of not acquiring something causes great anxiety for somebody with hoarding disorder. And also accumulation of so much stuff that it prevents the normal use of space. Like that's really the key. It's not somebody who might have a lot of clutter because maybe they moved from a 4-bedroom house to a 1-bedroom apartment and they have a lot of stuff in their home because they're downsizing and they just haven't been able to go through all of them. Or maybe it's an older adult who physically can't go through all of those things. You have to have the attachment, the amount of stuff, and some people identify more with difficulty discarding than acquiring, but kind of both components are there. And so it would be somebody who can't sleep in their bed because there's so much clutter in their space, or can no longer use their kitchen for its intended purpose because of the amount of stuff that's in there. We see that a lot with the aging population that, you know, they're sleeping on like lounge chairs or recliners instead of sleeping in their bed because there's so much stuff in their rooms taking up that space and it's starting to impact their life in a negative way. Coming to the third sort of category of distress or impairment, that component is definitely there. It's impacting some aspect of their life and causing impairment. It could be social impairment, employment, financial impairment, especially for people who have a lot of stuff and have started putting things in storage units, and that's adding up to their additional cost. So then also not related to some other medical condition and not related to some other mental health condition. So when we talk about medical conditions, sometimes we might see this in older adults who also have dementia. If somebody has dementia and then the clutter began, that would not be considered hoarding disorder. But if the clutter began first and primary, that might be what we would consider to be hoarding disorder. And then not related to some other mental health condition, like somebody who has like schizophrenia or bipolar and went on a shopping spree or something to that effect, it wouldn't be considered hoarding disorder.
Courtney, I forgot to say in the beginning, did you want people to write questions if they had them in the chat and you'll go over them afterwards? Or
sure,
yeah. Do that?
Yeah, that's fine. I'll try to, can't really see the questions, but I did see the one about insight. So that is something that we'll get to. And I think
I wrote you something. I said, do the people who are having the hoarding disorder think they are impaired? Think
so,
there's a problem?
Yeah, it's interesting.
There's a problem. Okay.
Sometimes, usually the people who are in our program are able to identify that there's a problem. And sometimes that's because they internally see that there's a problem or have felt some sort of impact on their life because of the hoarding. Other times it's because of external sources are telling them that it's a problem. So maybe somebody's at risk of eviction or in Philadelphia, we have licensing and inspections, which is the people who go out and make sure that your home is up to city code and they're giving you violations, or your adult children or somebody else is telling you. So there's always that internal external struggle. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into intervention. Typically speaking, people who are diagnosed with hoarding disorder have a low level of insight. And so that's something that we have to work a lot on in our program. But everybody that comes to our program does so by choice. We don't force it. So the program started basically because we have an older adult care management program that serves people who are 65 and older. And of course, the goal is to help them age in place. Well, they were finding over and over again that clutter was a problem and sending in, I think it was Carl's clean out time and time again, and finding that within 3 to 6 months they would need Carl's clean out again. And it just kind of became this circular thing. So in 2014, shortly after hoarding disorder became a diagnosis, JFCS sought out funding, which allowed us to develop a 3-year program that we were able to continue after that. So when I started, we developed the hoarding program where we go in the homes and work one-on-one with people. And then we also have a group, support group component. So we'll get a little more into that. But so just to give you an idea of how relevant hoarding disorder is, between 2 to 5% of the population has hoarding disorder. If you start talking about it, maybe you yourself can identify or someone you know, usually everybody will say, oh, I know somebody, or I have a family friend, or I know somebody who knows somebody, or you've seen it in your clients. It's one of the things that maybe we don't talk about so often, but that we see in our communities quite a bit. So this just gives you some information about that. And another thing that I think a lot of people don't know is that Our program specifically caters to people who are older, 65 and older, but hoarding disorders often start in adolescence. So while we might not see it manifest itself in adolescence, the attachment to items or the symptomology behind it is there or can be present. I often tell a story when I talk about that I have a client who is in his late 80s, and he, throughout most of his life, he married at a young age, and his wife, she was able to kind of help keep the clutter at bay, so keep it out of the space so it never really became intrusive in their life. And then when she passed, of course, the clutter started to build up, and that's when we got involved. But he always tells me a story of when he was in elementary school, and he will never forget the day that his mom had been telling him to clean his room, and he didn't do it. And then he came home one day, and she had cleaned his room and taken out a lot of stuff. And he can still remember how he tells me he can still remember how he felt that day, of how distressing it was and how anxious and upset he was, because he didn't know where things were. A lot of things had been thrown out. It was just, it felt very chaotic, and he felt like he had just like a loss of control in that moment, even at that young age. So that's just to give you an idea of that it can start in adolescence, but often because adolescents don't have necessarily the access to a lot of items or to purchase items, and they usually have somebody there kind of keeping the stuff at bay. And also it takes a lot of time to create enough clutter for it to impact, like to fill your space or your home. So these are just a list of co-occurring disorders, and I'll share the slides with you so you can have this, but 92% of people with hoarding disorder have a co-occurring disorder. We see a lot of anxiety, depression, and ADHD in our program with the clients that we're working with. So there are some risk factors with hoarding. I would say the one that is not on here, but we should definitely mention, is trauma can be a risk factor for people who are hoarding. And more research is coming out about a genetic component of hoarding disorder. And that, you know, if you grew up in a hoarded home or you have family members who struggle with hoarding, that puts you at a higher risk. You know, we see this, we also have JFCS in Philadelphia has a Holocaust program, and we definitely see this in some of our Holocaust survivors or older adults who lived through the Depression, or people who might have experienced some sort of other trauma in their life, like the loss of a loved one, you know, something else that might have sort of triggered the hoarding to begin. But also that there's no typical description of who is hoarding. Some of it could be that, you know, it's a fairly new diagnosis, and so there's a lot more research coming out, and maybe we'll find out, you know, it's more common in this gender versus that gender. But as of right now, it's pretty equal in terms of who has hoarding and who does not have hoarding. The other place that we might see it more often is depending on income. So somebody who has, a higher socioeconomic status might have more resources to be able to spread the clutter around. They might be able to sustain storage units or have a bigger residence where they can have clutter in various parts of their home. Whereas somebody who has a lower income or maybe lives in subsidized housing wouldn't have that space or be able to afford a storage unit ongoing. And so all of the items are in their space, which is typically smaller. And then also they would have annual inspections. So we catch it a lot with people who are renting places where the inspections happen. A lot of times that's how people will get referred to us, because they're facing eviction. So we get referrals through the community legal services or property managers or things like that, who are really trying to work with their clients. So that those are places you might see it more often. So this slide really talks a lot about how hoarding disorder impacts the individual, and then also how it impacts the community. Because one of the things that we partner with the Philadelphia Hoarding Task Force, and it's really important to understand how hoarding not only impacts the individual, but the larger community, because that helps us to know who we need to educate and who we need to bring on board when we're building a team around somebody who is dealing with hoarding disorder. So it could impact their relationships with loved ones. It could, especially with the aging population, they might have home health aides or nurses or things like that coming into their home who might not want to come into their home or who might not be able to access their home in a safe way. It also puts them at risk, as well as emergency personnel who are going in. So we have a firefighter who is also on the task force with us. And one of the things that he's doing is a lot of research and data collection on how what they call heavy content, but hoarded homes, impact firefighters in certain situations. And we've had, they note that firefighters are at much greater risk and more deaths occur in homes with high levels of clutter than without, because it's hard to predict where the fire is going and things like that. So it really can create a significant problem for the community at large. But we've also had firefighters call us and report clients or ask us to intervene because of homes that they've identified as sort of no entry. Like if a fire were to break out in that home because of the level of clutter, it would not be safe for them to enter. So we really want to make sure and understand how we can intervene in those situations and let the people who are living there, the people who are dealing with hoarding, understand the risk and the safety factor that goes along with the clutter in their homes. So does anybody, I guess now might be an okay time. Does anybody have any other questions that they want to ask right now?
Can I ask a question? This is Christina. So mm-hmm. you're talking about the task force. Are there like members of certain professionals in that task force? How do you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So all the lists here of the on the community side, there are members from all of those organizations on the task force. So it's a lot of mental health organizations. It was actually started by our local community legal services because they were identifying a lot of evictions coming through of people who were hoarding. And because hoarding is a mental health diagnosis, they should have been able to apply for a reasonable accommodation, but rather they were being evicted because it wasn't identified as a mental health disorder. So they started this task force and it's really grown. It's been in existence for about 6 years now. And we have, Older Adult Protective Services are, a lot of aging services, child protective services, and the SPCA, the city code enforcement agencies, the fire department, victim services from the police are all a part of it because, you know, especially in really anywhere, but in Philadelphia, it's a city of row homes. So, you know, if you're in a high-rise building in Center City or you're in a row home in one of the surrounding neighborhoods, you're not just putting yourself at risk, but you're putting your entire block or your entire apartment building at risk, especially if a fire were to break out or if there were an infestation and it, you know, that those kind of things spread. And they're really hard to treat if you don't treat the clutter first and start sort of at the source.
I just want to comment. I think it's a great thing that you guys have created this task force, something that to really think about in our area as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. What I was thinking is that, you know, who created that task force was JCFS, JFCS Philly, you know, part of the founding members mm-hmm. of this task force, because, you know, it seems like a lot of our agencies potentially could, you know, do something like this in their own communities. Mm-hmm. Or did they ask you to get involved? Like, how was it? Do you remember who was, you know, the impetus behind it?
So I know CLS was the starting factor. I was not around when JFCS joined, so I don't know the answer to that. But we are a very active part of it now. Right. And I myself co-chair the task force. And so, you know, we really, we're really trying to use that as a caveat to educating our community so that they understand the need and also to build resources, because not everybody is trained or understands how to work with people who are hoarding. So not only do we need to educate people, but we also need to build up the resources that we can refer to.
Right. It's definitely a niche, and it seems like it could be a niche where agencies could make money. Are you, mm-hmm. is it a profit? Is it for profit?
So our program is not at the current time being. So we are working on that right now. And one of the ways that we've been trying, a lot of the clients that we have are really low income also. So like 92% of the people we serve are at or below 250% of the poverty level. So private pay isn't really an option for the referrals that we have and the clients that we're working with right now. However, Pennsylvania has managed care. And so we're working with them to build in a supplemental plan for hoarding disorder so that we could be reimbursed for the services that we provide. And that's something that we're actively working on right now. It's been a really long process. There's been some transitions and, the other things are billing, private insurance is not all of our care managers in this program are licensed. And so we've had some limitations there. And I don't think everyone needs to be a licensed clinician to be a care manager in the hoarding program. It's also really hard to find staff who are interested in doing this because it is niche and you're often in undesirable working conditions when you're in hoarded homes that have infestations and high level of clutter. And things like that. So it's definitely something that finding staff who are interested in doing it is also a challenge at times. Mm-hmm. But so basically our program, we work with people who are 65 and older, whether they are homeowners, live in subsidized housing, or rent from private landlords. And we definitely we have two care managers in our program, and we work a lot in the community with various organizations to kind of help build a team around the person who's dealing with hoarding disorder. And we also work with the families. So a lot of times the families are sort of burnt out in dealing with their loved one with hoarding disorder. Sometimes they are involved from a distance. Sometimes they're not involved at all. Other times they're involved, but they're doing things like telling someone, just throw it out. Why do you do this? Like, aren't I enough to make you want to fix this situation? And so we have a family support group where people can come and attend and learn about hoarding disorder and also how to communicate with their loved one who has hoarding disorder. So how do hoarding interventions or intervention programs work? We focus on the person like we would with any other mental health intervention. We're really not focused on the stuff, although it is our goal to reduce the amount of stuff that somebody has in their home. But our focus is really on safety and the person's well-being. So when we meet with someone, we work really hard to develop relationships with them and to build trust, and then begins talking about, why are they holding on to this stuff? When did it start? Learning more and more about where they got it from. And then we talk a lot about safety because that's a really huge component, and often it's kind of like a softer way to approach the situation where we're not talking about like, how did you get here, but how can you be safe moving forward? How can we get rid of the least amount of stuff possible to help you have a safe and sanitary home? So we work in the home with people one-on-one, and then we also have our groups, which were in person prior to COVID. And then we'll sit there and do what we call sorting sessions with people. So we might have a keep pile and a discard pile and a maybe pile. And we're teaching people the skills of how to make decisions around their items. And also doing things like room mapping and categorizing so that we can help people kind of learn these skills so that when they're out and about and acquiring items, they start to ask themselves questions about bringing it in. Like, do I have a home for this? Why am I buying this item? Do I need this item? Do I have, they can set rules like when I have, 30 rolls of toilet paper, I won't bring in anymore, that kind of stuff. So we do a lot of just basic CBT skills work with people that we're working with. Again, we focus on safety, and then we do a buried in treasure support group. So this is an evidence-based group. And it's also a book. It's also a really good book if you're just interested in learning more about interventions with hoarding disorder. It's good to read, but the group follows the book. It's a 16-week group, 2 hours a week. So it is a really big time commitment, but we have a lot of interest in it. We actually have two cohorts running right now that are full. So we do get a lot of people who are interested in it. And I know there are some questions also. So we do have people who struggle with insight with it, but we also have people who identify with hoarding and they just don't know, you know, or have the skills to make decisions about their items. So I think the insight component really varies with people. Usually people who get to us acknowledge it's a problem in some way, whether because an external force is creating a barrier or an issue for them, or because they've identified it internally. Sorry. So we take a forward here. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I didn't know if you wanted to answer this. Benjamin has asked how COVID impacted the program and the work. Have your interventions changed? I don't know if you want to talk about that now or later.
Yeah, I can talk about it after this slide, because it sort of tells you what our approach is. So we have a four-tiered approach. Safety first is always the number one goal. So I have a handout that I can share with you guys and the assessment tools that we use, which help identify kind of what level of hoarding somebody is at and what are the key safety concerns that you want to be focused on first. But really it's following city code, like very basic stuff. Like you have to have a 3-foot walkway through your home, and that's pretty standard because that's what it takes for emergency personnel to get in and get you out. Making sure that all of your doors can open to their full capacity, and that all the doors are accessible in that way. So, you know, if you need to leave out your back door, you can open the full way, same with your front door kind of thing. And then we start looking at your spaces and how can we utilize those spaces for their intended purpose. So now we can access your bedroom and the fire safety issues have been removed. How do we now make this room a bedroom again and start reducing the items so that you can sleep in your bed? You can get the clothes out of your dresser and that kind of thing. And then the third transition that we make is more organizational. So now we're taking all the items that you have in your home, we're categorizing them, we're putting them in designated places, we're making it easy for you to navigate and find things. It doesn't happen quickly by any means. It's really helping somebody relearn the way that they've kind of adjusted their life throughout many, many years. A lot of times you'll see people with hoarding disorder who have kind of modified the way they get around their home or the way that they do things, because as the clutter has grown, they've had to adjust. And so they're relearning their spaces every time the level of clutter increases. So this is something that we're helping them adjust to. And we do a lot of taking pictures, so like showing before and after, because the visual can be really helpful for somebody with hoarding disorder. And some of the ways that we've had to adjust because of COVID. So in March, our organization went completely remote. I think a lot of organizations did. And so that was a big challenge. We were doing all in-person work with the hoarding program and mostly in-home work with the hoarding program. So we went from in-home to telephone overnight. And those clients of ours who have access to technology and comfortability in using technology, we're doing Zoom visits. So sometimes they will walk us through their homes with the camera on, showing us their spaces and showing us what they're working on that day. And instead of us being there hands-on, we're visually just walking them through what's going on. And other times people don't have access to technology. And so it's turned into more talk therapy on the phone for those clients, just helping them gain a deeper understanding of why they're hoarding, what their motivation is to make a change, how it's impacting their life and that kind of thing. And we've also sort of transitioned to more groups. So we were doing one BI, Buried in Treasures group before, and now we're doing two at a time. We also added an art therapy group for people who are hoarding. And we're doing a mindfulness group for people who are hoarding as well. So we've really tried to build up the group work so people can call in, they can video into those groups, as well as the family group. And it's been really interesting because we thought that would be really sort of detrimental to our ability to reach clients, but the groups have really taken off during COVID and a lot of people participate. They really like it. It helps keep them connected. And they feel like they're still working on their hoarding, even though we can't be in the home with them. So it really just kind of keeps them in the flow. We also have found that people who come to the groups first are generally able to learn more about hoarding and where it's coming from and how it impacts them. And so usually if they attend a group first, and like I said, the Buried Hidden Treasures group, it's 16 weeks. So it's, you know, a really intensive group. By the time they get into individual, they're at a much better place with usually greater insight. They've kind of heard the lingo before. They've taken a step or two working towards it. And so they're in a better place to start working with the individual stuff. And with the groups, those groups, they cap at 10 people and 2 facilitators. So they're not large groups, but they really become a safe place for people who maybe have never talked about their hoarding disorder to really find commonality in other people and find a place of support. So, and also learn some skills. So it's really good. Okay, so here's just some tips on how to engage with people who are hoarding. You know, utilize the same language that they are. If they're calling their items collections or things, we want to match that language. At least while we're building a relationship and building trust with them. Consider safety first over discarding items. So if you're working with someone and they're dead set on keeping an item, it's really not worth engaging in the power struggle over one item, but rather take the approach of safety and like, you know, oh, we have to clear, you know, your doorway, or we have to make a 3-foot walkway here. What are the things that you could let go of to make that space, instead of engaging in, well, that's trash, you don't need to keep that. What do you need to keep that for about one specific item or one type of item? When we engage in power struggles with people who are hoarding, we're never gonna win. And we burn out really easily when those things happen. And something else just for the provider, somebody who's working with someone with hoarding disorder, go into it expecting setbacks. There will always be setbacks. And so, it's something that we always tell our staff to just kind of maintain their own self-care. Like, don't get frustrated, just expect it and work through it and know that it's coming. So also identify their strengths rather than their barriers. Don't use language that can be perceived as judgmental or negative, like trash or junk. and also be cautious of your nonverbal cues. A lot of these things are not... If you're doing home visits for any purpose, a lot of these things are pretty common that we would follow. But be cautious of your verbal cues. There can be sometimes things in hoarded homes that you might not realize, like if there's a strong odor that you're making a certain face, or if you see something, you know, out of your corner of your eye that you look a certain way, just be really cautious of that because they do catch on to those things. And also don't touch anything without permission. Of course, that's, you know, not something that we talk about during COVID times, but when we're back in the homes or before, that was always a really important thing is, you know, you're in the space of somebody else and you're talking about it and will eventually be sorting through their belongings, something that they really, really value. And so you want to just be really respectful of that. And then ACEs is just kind of a way to remember some ways to talk to people with hoarding disorder. One of the key things that I point out here is curious questioning. Always ask about items or ask about where their items came from. Sometimes you might notice there's one item that stands out or a theme of items or something to that nature. And feel free to ask people, oh, where did you get that? Or tell me about that. That's really interesting. People like to talk about their items and where they got them from. And it also gives you some insight as to where it's coming from. So this is just a picture of all the different kind of safety issues that might happen in someone's home. I think it gives kind of a really good overview of all the different issues you might find in a hoarded home. So there's that. And then this is... kind of the end here, but there was a couple websites here that you could check out. It's the Philadelphia Hoarding website, the JFCS website, and then we're doing webinars. We typically have an annual conference every year in Philadelphia that JFCS along with the task force puts on. And this year, of course, we had to convert it to a web series. And so we've had some really great presenters and you can learn more about that on our website. We have one in the series left. So that's what we got. Sorry, I'm not sure if I answered all of the questions in here, but I think we did.
Do other people, I have a couple questions and I want to open it up to other people as well before we talk about some other things. Again, thank you so much, Courtney. This was really helpful, and it's kind of incredible work that you're all doing in Philadelphia. I think you're way ahead of most of us in other parts of North America. My question is, it was referenced on a slide, and this is something we've seen with other, with clients with hoarding disorders, that it took something like 95 visits and 120 hours to help a client. And so, you know, it's our experience that it's just such intensive work and so expensive, really, because it's so much staff time that we're not able to really help people very much. Yeah. You know, our whole approach is just really about the 3-foot walkway, I'll be honest, and safety, and like that's as far as we pretty much can ever get in our world. And so I'm wondering if you have thoughts about that. It'd be interesting to know sort of what the caseload size is of care managers, and is there anything in between that's helpful to clients besides the full approach and the minimal, just basic safety work?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think this is one of the biggest barriers to hoarding disorder interventions, is that it is really time consuming to be able to impact change in people's lives. And so one of the ways that we're trying to accomplish like creating more resources for people to be able to offer this through the task force is really collecting data through the city. So we're working with like older adult protective services, and they're looking at how often do they do cleanouts and what are the costs of it? How often do they do extermination services and what are the costs of those for people who have clutter? And they're finding that they're doing it every 6 months over and over again, and they're spending hundreds of dollars, sometimes thousands of dollars every time. And that's just one organization, right? What are the resources that places like, or city agencies that do code enforcement, spending on resources of staff time going out to homes that are hoarded, giving them violations, doing cleanouts, doing the work, and then never getting recouped for those bills. So really understanding the impact of the community and the cost on the community. And so we're working to, and the hoarding, or the Mental Health Association in San Francisco has a hoarding program, and they did this, and they came up with some, I think it was like $7 million or something like that annually, that was the cost on the city. And that wasn't even all the data, because you're talking also about like, how much money do people spend in eviction court for people who are hoarding? How much do landlords spend on cleanup after they evict somebody in a hoarding situation? What other services in the city are being drained or utilized rather than mental health resources? And how can we kind of redirect some of those dollars? So it's not a quick or easy process by any means, but it's something that we're working on. And then also in creating it to be a supplemental plan through managed care, so that we can get reimbursed for this specific intervention. Because if we can get reimbursed for this intervention, other mental health agencies can get reimbursed. And then it opens the door to people being able to financially sustain a program like this.
That's right. 95 visits, 95 reimbursements. You're making money suddenly, you know?
Yeah.
That'd be amazing.
Right. And on top of that, the groups. So the groups, the Buried in Treasure group is evidence-based. And that I would say is, if you are not able to do the one-on-one intervention, that maybe even just looking into starting a group. The groups are also not a small ask. It's, you know, two staff for every cohort that you do, and it's 16 weeks, 2 hours a week. So it's not an insufficient amount of time. But I think one of the things that we found when we started doing this group was that there was a much greater need even for the groups and desire for people to be in this group than what we could manage. So we have a waiting list of people waiting to get in the next cohort. Right. So that's always something that you could do.
So someone asked, you know, is there a fee? I think this is a little bit of a joke to use the name for your Buried in Treasures group. Or could other agencies, you know, use the same name?
Oh yeah, because it's you can use the name. It is
the
it's not ours. Yeah, it's the name of the book, right? So the book comes with, there's the book, and then they also developed a facilitator guide for the book that you would have to get training for to do the group and do the facilitator guide. So we did.
Maybe we'll pay you, NJHSA, we'll pay Courtney Owen, JCFS, to train some of us, if that's interesting.
Sure, we'd be happy to. Yeah, it's a really great group. And I think it also offers, we have learned so much as facilitators of this group in just understanding hoarding disorder and working with the individuals. It's been really enlightening.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. And does anyone else have any other questions?
I have a question. Would anyone be interested if potentially we were to get JCFS Philly to train us in Buried in Treasures facilitation? Would people be interested in that? I'd also offer it to the clinical services group, I imagine. But one person here, I can't see, some of you guys are still, you don't have your pictures on, but maybe you're writing them in there. Okay, a few people are. Okay, good to know.
Great. I did ask, what was the size of the caseload for the care manager?
Oh, I'm sorry. We have two care managers in the program right now, and we also have an intern. So each person has somewhere between 8 and 10 people in their individual work at any given time. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, thank you so much. This is really, I think it's an issue that unfortunately so many of us have seen in clients' homes, and an issue that is challenging for everybody, both the individual and honestly our care managers. It's a really hard, it's hard to support people and be in homes in this kind of situation. So thank you so much. I think many of us will be interested in more training, and all the materials you mentioned, would love to have those materials as well. So
if you send us on Courtney, I can put them in the resource library and people can get them that way.
Great.
That'd be great.
Sounds good.
So, sorry, Adam.
Go ahead. Oh, okay. So I'm just as a reminder, Courtney's presentation was fantastic. And if there are other agencies doing really innovative things, we are always open to having all of you be presenters. So if there are innovative programs, please be in touch with Lisa or me or Christina about that. Related to that, I do want to turn the floor over to Christina to make an announcement.
Thank you.
And then Lisa also has some announcements, and then maybe we'll have some time for sharing as well at the very end. So I'll turn it over to Christina.
Thanks. Thank you, Adam. This is the dreaded moment. So this is going to be my last meeting as a co-chair. I have accepted a job at the Area Agency on Aging. So going to be moving there in the middle of January, but this has been great. I love seeing you guys and sharing all of the information with you and learning from you. So I will miss you. But so on that note, we will be looking for another co-chair for Adam. And Lisa, as far as I understand, the commitment will be a year, or would you like to do a 2-year commitment?
Well, it's generally a 2-year commitment, but someone can only do a year, you know, you can only do a year.
Yes. It's honestly, it gave me a lot of satisfaction to be a part of this group and be one of the co-chairs. Adam and I have known each other from a previous engagement that we did together, so we work well, but he's great. So I would encourage you, if you have an interest, please reach out to Lisa and take my place over.
There's only one prerequisite, and that really is that your supervisor or your CEO just needs to, you know, sign off on it, because it does take time away, because, you know, you plan these kind of programs and then you're on the affinity group. So it would be great if anyone's interested, you know, reach out to me. Because,
and if you guys have any questions, you know, if you want any feedback, you can email directly to me. My last day will be January 15th. So I'm still here at the agency for a while. I can give you some insights.
Well, thank you, Christina. You are an excellent co-chair, and always thinking. You know, the last conversation that I had with her, a lot of it's done via email. Christina said that she felt what would be really good for people in the affinity group might be to provide some sort of leadership trainings, right? So we've now been thinking about what can we do for, you know, managers in terms of leadership. Like, we always are listening to what you all have to say, and we want to do what's best for you. So, you know, you have an opportunity to make a difference for not only your own affinity group, but for the network at large. So there's our big plug about the affinity groups. And we're going to miss you, Christina. Thank you so much. What I wanted to just say is that Adam said, if anyone has a program that they want to present, that's great. You can present it here. But I also want to say that we sent out, and maybe you got it, I hope you did, the RFP for our virtual annual conference. And we are actually doing a program showcase of older adult services programming. So there'll probably be 8 to 10 programs featured during that program showcase. And I'm hoping that some of you will send in, you know, a program that you're doing. It's 5 slides, 8 minutes is the presentation. And, you know, I know that you guys are all doing some really interesting things. And what the best part about program showcases is maybe it can be replicable. Like, we just found out from Courtney that potentially we're going to learn about, you know, how to facilitate Buried in Treasures support groups for family members who have hoarders in their family. So out of your programs, we can learn from you too. And I'm hoping that it'll be really exciting and that many of you will be interested in submitting your proposals. So that's my plug. That's that. And now it's up to you. We got 15 minutes. You guys can talk about whatever it is you want to talk about. And Courtney was supposed to be presenting that last year in person at the annual conference, mm-hmm. right? Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That was going to be one.
Yeah.
That's why I knew that she had it. And I thought it was really, mm-hmm. you know, important for this group. So does anyone have anything they want to talk about?
No. Wow, it's a quiet group today.
I might ask something. I'm Rebecca Rosenau from South Jersey, Cherry Hill. And just as we are getting more and more calls, some people are interested in our case management services, but obviously we're not going into the home. So again, just to follow up on any creative ways that staff are doing virtual assessments, getting to know potential individuals who are in need of case management or virtual volunteer services. Has anybody done virtual assessments? Is everybody only doing virtual services, or is anybody still going into the home from a social work standpoint?
This is Christina. I can answer. Florida, Clearwater, we have only done virtual since March. We're not going in clients' homes, but if they have an ability to use smart device, then we can do a FaceTime or WhatsApp call with them and to be able to see the house. With adult protective service cases, now the investigators, they send us pictures of the place, so that really works because we're not able to go in a client's home.
We sometimes in San Diego, where we are blessed with amazing weather, do things outside in backyards or front yards. And so that's been a way for us to do some of the assessments. Clearly it's not the same, but we've been doing that, and that's been working. But there are a lot of clients where we can't help, but we do what we can, and we do with the some. There are some clients who are totally isolating because they have no one but our staff going in that we are continuing to see. But we do shop for clients, and we do assess and keep safe distance, and. But it's not the same as going into a home the way we've done in the past, for sure. But we try to do the best we can.
Jennifer was going to say something, and then you
go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say the same as Hetty. Jennifer in West Palm Beach, we are sometimes blessed with good weather, a lot of rain, but sometimes good weather. And we slowly have been doing some outdoor client visits, socially distanced with masks, still doing virtual assessments as well, just depending on the risk factors on both sides. So it's really on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. And what was Brenda going to say?
Well, in Montreal, we're not blessed with warm weather. It's quite chilly. It was like -7 this morning with the wind chill. So we're not doing outside visits, guys, but we are doing everything still virtually. We are what we're called in a red zone. We're like the highest number of cases in all of Canada.
Oh.
So we're really not doing any, nobody's going into the building at all. Very little staff are going into the building and only with appointments. So the case management is done virtually still. We do have home care workers that do go in with all the safety precautions, and that's to help people with, you know, cooking, cleaning, their daily needs. We still have people doing some shopping for some people, especially for those that of our Holocaust survivor group. But case management is all virtual still.
Have you has anyone taken on new clients since COVID started doing a virtual assessment? And if so, have you tweaked your multifunctional assessment to make it a little bit more user-friendly, not as many pages and so on since it's virtual? Or are you still doing the full assessment?
So I can answer it to you, Rebecca. Since we are completely virtual, we have enrolled a lot of clients, I think like over 300 since the COVID times, and we have done them all virtually. Yes, my case managers complain and social workers that they're not able to assess the environmental situation or see the client. So we just write a note, unable to, you know, observe the environment, and then we can update it once we're actually able to get back into that client's home. And we'll update the assessment. But for us, our assessment is state mandated, so we can't tweak.
Similarly, we're in Seattle, we're doing our best with, we have enrolled some new clients with doing as much of the assessment on the phone. We are going into clients' homes in some cases. Most of our visits are outdoors, although because of the weather, it's not Montreal, but it's not Florida or San Diego. So we have allowed staff to go into clients' homes. They have N95 masks, face shields, gowns, and gloves on. And quite honestly, we're in homes where there are often home care aides that are just wearing a mask. So, you know, and we also keep distance from our clients. The truth is our clients are getting personal care from staff who are just in masks often. So the reality is people are coming into clients' homes anyway. So we are scaling that back though with rising case counts. We watch the case counts pretty closely, and every visit does need to be approved by a supervisor to make sure that it's essential and that there's no way it can be done over the phone, because most of our work is over the phone if it's not in person. But we do, and we require staff to watch 2 videos about putting on and off equipment. So if you want, I can share that with you. But so we do have a pretty extensive protocol and are still doing some in-home visits.
You know, yesterday on the volunteer affinity group, they were talking about something. Maybe you guys have heard about it. AnyDesk? Have you heard about AnyDesk? They have how to teach people how to use the technology, you know, seniors how to use technology. Something like, I was going to look it up. And then AARP has a lot of different programs that you can look at that has training instructions. I don't know. And then I'm so glad I have this written down here. And then Echo Dot, I guess echodot.com also has some training instructions. I haven't looked at them yet, but I thought that was interesting because, you know, everyone's always saying that people can't understand how to use smartphones or how to do, you know, their computers. So maybe that could be helpful for some of the seniors if they have smartphones. It's not easy.
No, I looked up this AnyDesk. It looks like it's just the software that you could share your information through. But I think AARP, they had that Google Chrome program, but I'm not sure if they actually teach in at least our local one. So I've checked into that.
Christina, I'm curious how you have been able to use FaceTime since it's not HIPAA compliant.
Actually, we've been told that FaceTime and WhatsApp are the only 2 HIPAA-compliant platforms that we can use for clients.
the WhatsApp and
FaceTime. My staff has, we have work phones, so they're not allowed to do it on their personal phone, but we have the company issued cell phones, and those are the two platforms we're allowed to use. We do have telehealth platforms, but those are mostly used for counseling.
Right.
But yeah, WhatsApp and FaceTime.
Okay.
I had no idea that they were HIPAA compliant.
I know, neither did I, but, and again, maybe it's because it's a company issued phone and there's some other level of protection. You know, I'm not pretending to be an IT person. So,
because when we've Googled those trying to get more information, mm-hmm. it's not.
Yeah. And I know from everything that you hear, you'd think it wouldn't be, but those are the only two that we're allowed to use for clients.
Because we were told only Zoom.
Oh, Zoom is a no-no for us.
Not all Zoom is HIPAA compliant. You have to purchase the HIPAA compliant
version, yeah,
which is a lot more expensive than the regular Zoom.
Yeah.
But
all in all, we've done well, even just, you know, regular phone visits. Again, it's not exemplary case management, you know, when you're not able to see the client, but it will have to do in this situation.
Right. You have to use your case manager's intuition.
Exactly.
Whether there's something amiss, and then you take a different step than just monitoring
through
case management. So does anyone else have anything they'd like to share with us, ask a question in these remaining moments before Thanksgiving? What?
Lisa, I just put in, I don't know if you can get it in the States or not, but I put it in the chat. It's something called Connected Canadians, and something specifically for seniors. They screen the people who call in, and you can either do group or individual sessions, and they'll give you free sessions for up to 60 minutes for anything that has to do with technology, whether it be your iPhone, how to connect on Zoom, how to store your photos.
Perfect. So I'm looking into that right now.
It's a totally free service, and it's done by volunteers that were trained, and they're usually somebody with some sort of technical background. So
you think that everyone could use Brenda Ewan as their name and email address? I'm kidding.
Go right ahead. But I don't think they'll do it. Anyways, it's a free federal, like it's a government program that's being given. So we often refer people there. We do our own in-service one through our volunteer group, but we also send them to this group as well.
Interesting. Abby had something to say, yeah.
I was just going to say, we're very small, but we do have a group of tech volunteers that we've trained, and, you know, the people who have signed up for this are techies to begin with, and they have been incredible.
That's a great idea. That's a good program to talk about. Where are you, Abby?
Yeah, pardon?
Where are you?
Raleigh,
uh-huh.
Yeah. So, you know, Tracy. Tracy is our volunteer coordinator, and she's the one who has organized it, but it is working. It could be like a one-shot thing, like how do I fix my phone, or it could be talk me through how to use Zoom, and it is working.
That's terrific. Techie volunteers.
Yeah.
It seems so simple, right? But someone has to coordinate it and get the people. But I think that there are a lot of college students that would be very interested in getting some, you know, community service hours, because from what I understand, the very first question that college students are being asked in interviews is, what did you do during this pandemic? You know, they want to see that they're doing something for others rather than just watching TV and sleeping late. So
it's been a mixed bag as to who signs up. A lot. There are some retirees who are very good with technology, but there are also professionals who are, you know, like I spoke to one guy, he's an IT professional at University of North Carolina, and he just does this. He likes helping.
That's a great idea. Reach out to colleges around there.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent.
Sorry, Lisa, in the summer, we had a summer student that helped us put together a manual for how to access Zoom. And we share that with our seniors as well. It's like a step-by-step process.
If you want, I could share that with us so we can share that with the entire country. The United States. That would be great. Put your name on it. Put the, you know, your agency.
Oh, I'll put the Cummings name is on it for sure. I didn't do it. It was through the volunteer committee that did it, the volunteer department, but they had a student that worked on developing that. So fantastic. I'll ask
to share that. So we have to end, but remember to send that so I can put it in the resource library. Courtney, you'll send that, and anyone else who has anything they think would be beneficial, send it on. That would be really good. And Christina, we're gonna miss you. Thank you so much.
Oh, I will miss you guys, but I'm sure you'll do just fine without me. And thank you. It's been an honor and a pleasure, and I appreciate all of your support. Thank you.
Onward and upward.
Yes. Well, have happy holidays.
Happy holidays, everyone. Thank you, Adam, too. If anyone wants to be the co-chair, reach out to me. And thank you all so much. Courtney, I'm going to be in touch.
Bye. Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you so much for your time. Yep. Bye, everyone. Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.